Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Well, we met a group of moms who are enjoying quality childcare for their kids. And get this, it's not just cheap, they don't pay a dime.
This is the Debunking Economics Podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
Yep, she's talking about a childcare cooperative where parents share the babysitting responsibility with others in the circle. You take it in turns, basically, to babysit without paying anyone. It's barter, basically. Easy with two couples because you just take it in turns. But throw many more people into the equation and then you need a system like the one in Washington, D.C. back in the 1970s, a babysitting cooperative that has attracted a lot of interest from economists, mainly because many of them were part of the cooperative. So did it help them to understand how the monetary system works? We'll look at that today on the Debunking Economics Podcast. So what can we learn from a babysitting group in Washington, D.C. in the 1970s? It has been one of the most talked about economic parables, mainly because Paul Krugman has talked about it in his New York Times column and a couple of books. I know how much Steve loves Paul Krugman. So let's see what we can learn from the Capitol Hill Babysitting Cooperative. It comprised of members, mainly congressional staffers, who thought the easiest way of sharing babysitting responsibilities was to issue vouchers or scripts, and each script equated with half an hour's babysitting. So when you join the cooperative, you were given several. You use them up, then you wanted to go out, you'd have to then, they were gone, so obviously you'd have to go and babysit someone before you could go out again to earn some new vouchers. So Steve, I mean, in a way, it was its own closed currency, wasn't it? So what could possibly go wrong?
Oh, that's the theme of some of the articles. I mean, the thing going wrong is that in my opinion, is that all these mainstream economists spend their time talking about parables and never apply the same analysis to their own parables about the money creation system. And I've been doing that just recently for a conference coming up in Scotland, where I'm going to be presenting a paper with Stephanie Kelton on using Minsky to prove the principles of MMT. And you apply Minsky's double entry bookkeeping to the conventional parables of money creation in economic textbooks, and they fail. They simply can't work the way they think they do. But let's we'll talk about this.
Well, I think the reason I wanted to talk about this, because I think if you apply some of the logic to this, then they would be questioning some of their approaches, but they don't. They seem to blithely follow this through. I mean, one of the issues wasn't it, that people started hoarding. You know, if I hang on to my vouchers and others do the same, then that you get this imbalance. There's some people who've got loads. There's some people who want to go out who can't because they've already used theirs up. And that was part of the problem. So the answer, obviously, is to print more money, isn't it? Would you say it's a liquidity issue? It's certainly a shortage, isn't it, of cash that's stopping the economy
You've got hoarding, and that's the important point, that people want to hang on to the script because they think if they have babysitting scripts, then when I get an invitation, I can just use that to get somebody else to babysit for me and I can go to the party. And then if you're into the stage you've got zero, then you can't get somebody from the babysitting cop, you've got to pay for somebody outside with real money, obviously. But yeah, if you're trying to make sure that you've got some on hand, then everybody's trying to hoard the ones that exist. And if you have excessive hoarding, then you know nobody is because you've all got capacity to buy, but then you want to buy people's time, and nobody's providing the time to do the babysitting because they've already got enough of them.
Right.
So yeah,
but actually, just issuing more scripts, which is what they did. You would have thought would be part of the answer. Wasn't it the case that they had just restricted it by too much? Because there's only so many nights that you'd want to go out. I mean, you get over that problem in the short term. You go, well, okay, let's just issue. We seem to have ground to a halt. Let's just issue more money. What does that do to the value of the money? Well, it's still only worth the same, isn't it? It's still only half an hour's babysitting. It actually doesn't change the value of each voucher in any way. All it's doing is sort of fixing a bit of a liquidity problem. There's just not enough money going around. If you had twice as much, for example, then maybe things would start moving again. Because you're only going to hoard so many hours worth because you can only use it for babysitting.
Yeah, I mean, and this is, I've started putting together a Minsky model to take a look at this and see how it might work out. And it's a bit weird because it's much easier to use Minsky to model the real monetary system than it is to model a fictional one like this, because you've got to work out what the hell is the demand and so on. But the basic idea, this is effectively another issue in double entry bookkeeping and what is required to keep it going. And if you look at the idea of scripts themselves, you know, the script, that the little thing, this is half an hour's of babysitting credit, and you've got to have those to be able to get somebody to babysit for you, and then they might use that themselves later. What I did was I divided the members into two groups, the homies, and you're familiar with that expression, the homies?
Well, people who just hang around at home a lot.
Yeah. My American ex-wife used to use the expression quite regularly. It was appalling the piece of put down in American New York culture, as it turns out. But homies and party animals are your two groups. And then
you're going to say party animals.
And the party animals try to accept every invitation, so they've got a very high demand for scripts. And the homies regard using the script as wasting what they've got, so they use a waste script. And then I haven't actually finished putting the model together, but of course what can happen if the party time people accept every invite, then bang, they're going to run out. At that point they can't accept any more invites, so you have a break in the system, and that's what they, you know, the neoclassicals would call a liquidity trap, which they think explains the Great Depression. Of course, as usual, they're totally wrong. But the point which I've just got to in putting this together was that if you're going to have the script, you have to think about money in double entry bookkeeping terms. So if you have scripts in people's hands and the scripts are an asset of the people who've got them, but they're a liability of the organization that issues the script. And then when you take a look at this, and I've only just mucking around, I don't think I'll actually necessarily finish this unless somebody pays me large amounts of money to annoy Paul Krugman. But what I had was, if there's, say, 100 scripts in existence and 80 of the scripts are with the homies and 20 with the party animals when you start the whole thing, maybe I start 50-50, but, you know, 80 homies, 20 party animals, that means that the scripts have a negative equity because the managers have created the scripts and they're circulating amongst the members. The managers of the baby co-op have a net equity of minus 100. And that balances the positive equity of plus 100 of the members. And that is the first insight. Pardon the French, but you describe neoclassical economists, morons or idiots is the first word that come to mind. I'll go with morons for this discussion. The morons don't look at and say, oh, that's interesting. So for this system to work, the issuer of script must be in negative equity to enable the user of the script to be in positive equity. I wonder if that has any application to the monetary system. Yes, you morons, it does, because for the government to be, for people to be able to use the script created by the government, which we call money, then for that script to exist, and that lets the private sector be in positive equity with the money they earn, the government has to be in identical negative equity. And that's a necessary element of being in a monetary system. So the first thing that I take out of this is, hey, guys, get a hold of Minsky and model the bloody system the way it actually works and see how your own models are myths.
Well, I think you just described it, really. I mean, so they could go into deeper negative equity just by issuing more.
That's what I've added.
Would you call it a liquidity trap? The fact that it's moved to that imbalance and therefore the movement has stopped?
Well, the liquidity trap side of it comes that if you look at it, you take my group of homies versus party animals, the party animals accept all the invites they've got, then at some point they run out of script and they can no longer get homies to go babysit for them because they can't actually pay the homies with the script the homies are trying to accumulate. So at that point, the liquidity trap is with the party animals who suddenly find they can no longer go out and party. And so that's the idea of a liquidity trap. But the point, and this comes back to the whole issue of how do you explain the Great Depression, that was the way that effectively Hicks reinterpreted Keynes to say that what would actually cause the crisis was a liquidity trap, where you couldn't drive by driving the price down, you couldn't drive demand up. You reached a point where people didn't have the capacity to execute their trades, and that was what caused the Great Depression. Now, in all of this, in their analysis, they completely ignored the level of private debt. And that sort of turns up to some extent in a bit further elaboration of that babysitting thing, as far as I've seen, because they started allowing people to borrow from the the managers, to borrow scrip and then use that and have to pay them back. And that, in a sense, is a form of private debt turning up as well. Because, of course, in the case of if you're a party animal and you want to be able to go out and you haven't got any scripts, and therefore you've got to borrow them from the managers. When you borrow them from the managers, you've got to repay them in babysitting, which means you've got to go and babysit.
It's like you borrow, you've always got to pay back. But that process of borrowing, the administrators presumably would have to issue more scrip to borrow as well.
Yeah. So I've got that going on as well. So I've got, and this is trying to put it out in double entry bookkeeping terms, you have the asset of the members, when you look at the members themselves, the asset the members in total have of the scrip they currently possess. And so I've got like 100 scrip in existence, and homies have 80, and the party animals have 20, and that's the overall allocation. And then when you get the hoarding getting to the point where the party animals ran out, the only way that can be fixed is by the managers issuing new scrip. So they, by adding the new scrip, is effectively a liability of the managers. So to issue it, they've got to go into a negative equity. So they start off with a negative equity of 100 scripts they've issued, and if they want to double the scripts in existence, they've got to go into minus 200. So in this sense, this is like a fiat currency. The way that, and this is something which I only realized by using Minsky to work out the logic in the monetary system, the only way you can create fiat money is for the government to go into negative equity. And in this sense, I actually quite like the babysitting.
Yeah, is kind of a good analogy in lots of ways, isn't it? I mean, it's overly simplifies, but raises a lot of questions. So on that, the 80-20, where they eventually it becomes 100-0. Does size, if it was a massive babysitting club, would that still happen? Is there a size element to all of this? Was it just too small to work? So is it sort of like, US economy versus a small third world economy type situation going on here?
There's all sorts of potential to distort the conversation there, but I'll restrain myself. it is partly scale, but I think with the other point they made, and this is something I was trying to put into the model as well, was a seasonality of invites. So you're going to have lots of invites during summer and very few during winter. And so what I've added to that is what that would mean is I'd need to have a cyclical economy in that sense, generating the demand for parties versus less parties. I could actually make this part of a Goodwin model. In fact, I could include the number of parties taking place being a function of the level of boom in profits. So this could get nice and twisted, which would be good fun. But the seasonality alone is an issue. So you have lots of demand during summer, very little demand during winter, and then that will affect the distribution. But the larger you make the system, the more likely it is you're going to have people who are going to have, need the babysitting, and therefore they're willing to do it for you in the future, et cetera.
And presumably the more scrip you have as well, because you could get over that issue about the fact that no one is babysitting over winter, but some will be, but not many. So there'll be a bit of an imbalance, but most of the demand is in summer. That would be a reason to say, well, okay, we need more scrip to try and solve that liquidity issue. But it only works, surely, if there's a reasonable element of short supply. Because you want to, there's going to be a lot of demand, and people have to have the incentive to go out and do some babysitting as well as being babysat or having a babysitter in. So there needs to be that element of demand. There needs to be an element of, I hate to use this word because I know economists don't like to use it, but there's got to be an element of scarcity in those tokens. So you want to have enough of liquidity, but you don't want to have too much, do you?
Yeah, and this is the issue they found themselves trying to balance all the time, because sometimes there'd be too much scrip and sometimes too little. But yeah, I mean, the essential point, and this is what I wish they'd sit down and try to model this idea in something which can handle it, which is, my Minsky software, double entry bookkeeping. And the only way to increase the number of script in existence is for the manager to go into negative equity. And that negative equity of scripts for the managers creates positive equity of a script for the members, and that enables trade to take place. So in that case, with a fiat currency, which is what this amounts to, you need the issuer of the fiat currency to go into negative equity. Hey presto, you need what are called budget deficits.
But how far do you go with that? That is the that's the eternal question, isn't it, for governments and for babysitter cooperatives. So we'll look at that when we come back on the Debunking Economics podcast. Me and Steve Keane, back in a second.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is the Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
So this week we are looking at the Washington Childcare Cooperative as it was in the 1970s and how this is being used as an analogy for how the monetary system, how an economy works. A pretty closed economy, it's fair to say, with only one product, which is babysitting. Steve made the point just before the break that really it shows that there's a need to create extra script, which means that needs to be created by the administrators of the scheme, which means that you basically have a government that's going into deficit. But how much script do you create? Because if you create too much and everyone's got loads of it, then there is absolutely no reason for anybody to babysit for somebody else because they've got more than enough for them to use. So it inhibits that that incentive to work, doesn't it? Which is a problem if there's too much cash. Isn't that what happens?
Yeah, well, and that part I've still got to go through the logic. What actually happens when you have too many scripts? Do you stop? Because the thing is, this is not, in this sense, it's not a legal tender. Because if I give you a script saying half hour babysitting, that doesn't force you to accept that script. You can turn it down. Whereas when we look at fiat currency, money in general, if you go into a shop and the shopkeeper has items on the shelves, which is the same as a person who could babysit having free hours. When I tender, my $150 for a new microphone, then if that's the price advertised, then the retailer is obliged to give, or they are breaking the whole definition of legal tender. So you don't have that. Legal tender doesn't exist in this idea of the babysitting co-op.
And that's but I mean, it's an agreement. It's an agreement, though. It's an understanding, isn't it? So presumably everyone's playing ball on it. But the idea that it fluctuates means that you have to fluctuate the amount of script in circulation, doesn't it? You almost need, it's almost like the administrators are almost like performing a role of a central bank or a treasury. How do we make sure there's the right number of scripts in circulation? And how do we change that? Now, they do change it because when they get new members, I think when everyone joins, they get 30 hours or 30 scripts. When they leave, they have to hand back 20. So, if they might have credit left, which they're just going to hand in anyway. But it means that there's sort of like it helps the turnover of new people coming in. They create new script for them. So the incremental, supposedly incremental 10 hours every time you get a new member. So that helps. So it's related to the population. So it's actually like saying, well, okay, this is money creation related to growth in the population, which is something that governments have great difficulty trying to get their head around as well.
But yeah,
and is that important? Is that an important factor if you're trying to control and, you know, the amount of money in the circulation? Do you have to look at the population and say, well, actually, if the population grows, the money in circulation should increase as well?
Yeah, I mean, and this comes down to the issues about how does the monetary economy function, and like the fact that neoclassicals try to pretend we live in a barter system and ignore the monetary system, and that's what they do with their models. They're not trying to seriously model money. They're trying to find excuses not to model money. So they come up with a money multiplier model, which doesn't work unless crazy conditions apply. I'm happy to chat about that in the second half. Or they use loanable funds, which doesn't have any money creation to it. So they leave out the essential elements of the real world because they don't want to talk about them. But when you do start talking about the real world, then yes, you have to look at things like seasonality. You have to look at the question of if you have excessive accumulation of money, what does that do to the system? And the thing which I can see about this little system they've got is that they have a way of adding new money, which then they can create new scripts, and they link the number of new scripts of people becoming new members as well. But they don't have any way for them to decay. And this is one of the points of the Gazellian currency, that it would actually help to have a currency which depreciated over time. So if you didn't actually use your scripts,
then they're worthless, or they lose value.
The easy way would just say they're
valid for a year. Well, that would be the easy way. When people are joining at different times, so it's not everyone runs out at the same time. It's not like the 2 o'clock taxi handover that we used to have in Sydney, where you couldn't get a cab at all.
I remember that.
But I mean, it's because you'd have that problem if everyone was issued a token at the same time. Everyone would be trying to wind them down at the same time, wouldn't they, before the end of the year? So it would be impossible.
They had 1 year validity from the date of issue.
But I mean, if people join at different times, then that would get over that issue, wouldn't it? Because then there's an immediate need to use them. Seems like a very simple solution. But I mean, it's a long way for us to go from that to applying that to the real world economy. But maybe that's what we need
The thing I'd like them to learn out of this, that if when you start looking at it, you've got to think in double entry bookkeeping terms. Maybe it might be a good idea to apply double entry thinking to the actual monetary system in which you live. And why don't we check out your models and see whether they actually fit and make sense in double entry bookkeeping terms? And so that's the insight I'd like Krugman in particular to get out of this. You try modeling, actually seriously modeling the money multiplier using double entry bookkeeping, and then tell me whether you should have it in your textbook or not.
Well, there's no, I mean, they can look at this and say, well, even without, thinking that far, there's no money multiplier here, is there? I mean, they would argue.
Well, they've got a fixed stock. That's true. They have done. It's the only. But the thing of the way they create, and this is a point which you can tie to this and apply to the insights of modern monetary theory, which of course contradict the people who are talking about this babysitting model. They don't have any explanation of how money is created that makes sense. But when you look at this and say, if you're going to create this new script and look at it in double entry book keeping terms, then the only way for this new money to be created is for the managers to deliberately go into negative equity to create positive equity for the members of the babysitting co-op. And that is fundamentally what modern monetary theory is saying about the money supply for a growing economy. If you're going to grow the money, if you're going to increase the money supply, and that has been, there's no economy on the planet which has grown with a shrinking money supply in terms of real output growing and money supply shrinking. It just doesn't happen. It might happen, we might get one or two quarters where it applies, but forget it for a general trend. That means if you had a growing economy, you need a growing money supply. How do you grow the money supply? The answer ends up being, when you put the double entry bookkeeping terms into it, if the Treasury spends more than it gets back in taxation.
So I wonder. I wonder whether how many of the people involved in this babysitting scheme were working for the Treasury, given it's all
quite a lot of them.
And wouldn't they be figuring out themselves? Hang on a second. In the real world economy, we are trying to restrict the supply of money. We don't like government spending at all. We're trying to restrict it. What would happen in their babysitting scheme if they said, well, okay, we are going to issue less vouchers, less spending by the government, and see how that works for the scheme? Well, they found, if they restrict it too much, they get this liquidity trap.
Yeah, but they don't do it. And this is, it's this to me, I think the problem here is that they have the world's most dangerous meme in their heads, and that most dangerous meme is the intersecting supply and demand curves. And if you try to get them to analyze anything, that's what they drag out of their toolbox, and it's completely inappropriate, not just for the monetary system, but for capitalism in general. So they've got a mangled tool they try to use. What they should really be doing is saying, let's look at this in double entry bookkeeping terms, and then bang, they suddenly find everything they believe goes out the window, which is the point where they don't want to go out the window. They want to stay home. In that case, the neoclassical economists are the ultimate example of homies.
I mean, the Austrians' school of thought.
Oh, please.
Well, I just have to say
that. Having a good morning, Uncle. Sorry, okay, you're right.
But I mean, the totally free market thinking here would be the problem they've got is that one voucher is worth half an hour of babysitting, and it shouldn't be that. It should be allowed to be determined by the person doing the buying and the selling how many hours of babysitting that voucher is worth. And so would that solve anything? Because you get to a stage where, okay, it's middle of winter, we do need a babysitter, there's people who are, you know, keen to do it. It's not worth as much. In summer, a script might only get you 20 minutes babysitting rather than an hour, for example. Would that solve the problem?
Potentially. I mean, this is an isolated market, and there's no, you know, the issues of marginal revenue and marginal costs, all that sort of jazz, don't really exist. There's a fixed supply of the things. You want to get the supply roughly equal to the demand at all times. So this is a bit like a load sharing issue for electricity generation. But you've got people hoarding at the same time, so you want to get them to not hoard. And so at various times, you'd want them to be taking advantage of a very good offer. You know, do 1 hour of babysitting now, get 2 hours for later usage, and so on. So it's the sort of thing where with the basic ideas of exchange in a neoclassical model would function moderately well, mainly because it's isolated. It's a single system. It's when you try to apply this thinking at the aggregate level, where it has to be systemic, and there are multiple commodities and multiple prices. That's when the whole thing just simply can't scale back past one product. So if we stuck with babysitting, maybe, you know, and because it's isolated from the rest of the economy, you're not using actual dollars to do it. Then yes, you potentially the price system could get you out of trouble.
On load balancing, by the way, just as an aside. I love the way I'm just about to take delivery of my new electric car, hopefully over the next day or two, but I've had the charger installed. I love the fact that the charger, you plug the car into the car charger, and that's logged into your electricity account with Octopus Energy. It's who I use. They charge me, I think it's 7.5 pence per kilowatt hour overnight when I'm charging my car, as opposed to the usual, I think it's like 27 or 30 pence per kilowatt hour, so 7.5, so substantial reduction. Even during the day, if my car is plugged in, say at 1 o'clock in the afternoon when it's peak time for electricity, if they go, well, do you know what, we've actually got a bit of excess supply at the moment, Phil's got his car plugged in, we'll let him have that at 7.5 pence. That's a good use of load balancing, isn't it? Because it's going into my battery and it's using power that I don't know what happens to excess power when there's not enough demand but there's peak production, but it soaks up that spare capacity. That's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm no expert on the electricity grid, but I'm aware that you basically you cannot have an imbalance between the flow and the demand and supply. Fundamentally, it's got to be absolutely matched, or you get breakdown in the mechanics of the system, which makes electricity, you know, very, very different. So that's where batteries come in as a potential storage element. But there's the scale of, you know, we just don't have the batteries to cope with the scale of fluctuation and demand.
Yeah, but we're getting there with cars and battery packs on the sides of homes and so forth. Anyway, I said that's a conversation for another day. Just so you're talking about load balancing reminded me about it. That's all. Just finishing off on this piece, Tim Harford wrote about this babysitting cooperative in the FT back in 2012. And he said, you know, what does this tell us about the global situation? If we've got the world's total income equals the world's total expenditure, what's going to do to spending when consumers try saving up, you know, in the wealthy parts of the world? I mean, it's, you know, it's taking it too far to apply on a global scale, but it just gets back to that hoarding issue, doesn't it? It's inherent. And I think what he's trying to say is, well, the rich are hoarding and the less wealthy nations are going to struggle from that because we're basically grabbing all the money.
I see the point which is left out of this call, which makes it not applicable to looking at the global economy, is that you don't have the repayment of debt. So when you look at the circulation, it's just entirely circulating between homies and party animals, as I've done it here, which is like circulating between savers and spenders. And when the spenders repay the savers, there's no change in the total stock. And that's the sort of world that neoclassical economists think in when they think about banking. They think that if somebody repays a debt, then they repay the person they borrowed it from, and the person they borrowed it from has got more spending power, compensating the fall in the spending power of the borrower. Therefore, overall, there's no major effect out of increasing or decreasing the level of private debt. That is bollocks when you apply it to the real world, because we don't borrow much from each other unless you make the mistake of lending to a family member or something like that. But if you normally borrow from a bank, then when you borrow from the bank, you increase the supply of money. When you repay the bank, you decrease the supply of money. And that's the essential thing that this baby cop leaves out. And that's one reason why it's misleading.
They're assuming that the relationship between the two members of the cooperative who are exchanging, and it's a one benefits, you know, and the other one loses out, or it evens out. They're assuming that exactly that same relationship between the person who's been issued the tokens from the bank and the administrators and the users of the system.
So this explains why neoclassical economists like it, because it's fundamentally a model of learnable funds. There's a certain amount of money in existence that circulates between you. If you pay somebody back, they get more, you have less. It's just a question of making sure nobody ends up with zero. That's the reason they like this model. But in the real world, when you borrow from a bank, that increases the supply of money in existence, and that can cause a boom. And then when you repay the bank, you reduce the amount of money, and that can cause a slump. So that systemic element of the real world is left out of this model, which is another reason why neoclassicals like talking about it.
Right, but it is in the model, in that they recognise that they had this liquidity issue. They need the only way out of it was to issue more, and they recognised that there was a need, as you got a greater membership, you needed to issue more as well. So there was an acknowledgement that you needed a bigger money supply. So it's
within
they don't seem to have learned from it. Rishi Sunak, for example,
hasn't learned. Yeah,
Rishi Sunak's trying to take all those scripts back as fast as he can, because
this is the thing which I've just been putting through. Like, if you look at what actually happens in when the government runs a surplus, it's actually destroying fiat money. And so all these people think it's great and important for the government to run a surplus. Think it's important to destroy fiat money, huh? You know, so that is the advantage of this particular model, because it shows, well, if you want the system to work and you've got hoarding going on internally, then you need to create new script. And the way you do that is you go into negative equity. Oh, that sounds like what the government does when it spends more than it gets back in taxation. So they should learn that lesson. But what they can never learn from this model is the lesson about private money, for credit money creation, and the fact that when you pay back credit money, you actually destroy money. And therefore, that repayment actually reduces the script in existence. And that's what caused – that's the real cause of the Great Depression, which they can never get out of this babysitting co-op model.
Right. Well, and yet, you know, this idea that the answer is more money was hiding for them in plain sight, but they just chose to ignore it. So there we are, an interesting analogy. And it seems like everyone's studying in great detail, but missing a few obvious things about it. That's it for this week, though. Thanks, Steve. Back again next week.
Bye. Bye.
The Debunking Economics Podcast.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favourite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.